Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. When Arthur invited me to make this presentation some months ago, I wasn't quite sure whether to accept or not, because to tell you the truth, the environment has not been a central area of research for me. Nevertheless, you know, there are interconnections between environmental issues and protection of the environment on the one hand, and our economic system and economic policies in general. And so I thought that perhaps I might share some thoughts with you on this subject. Let me begin by showing you an interesting chart. This shows the evolution of GDP per capita, which is a measure of well-being, of welfare, that is commonly used in the economics profession and in the development community, for a number of countries over a period of about 30 years. You can see up here Sweden. It was a very rich country back in 1975, and it is an even richer country now, 30 years later. The graphs that I want to focus your attention on are the following. Look at Brazil, the blue line, and Korea, the purple line. Korea had a per capita income that was well below that of Brazil in 1975. Sometime in the early 1980s, the lines crossed, and then thereafter, Korea took off, and it was much, much richer than Brazil is today. In fact, if you look at the line for Brazil, Brazil had already reached this level back in the early 80s, and it's not too much higher, you know, 20 years later. So the country has more or less gotten stuck at a little bit higher, but not much. The two other countries that I have chosen to include here are Nigeria, here at the bottom, with a per capita income roughly where it was 30 years ago, notwithstanding the fact that over that 30-year period, the country has probably exported $600-700 billion of oil. Nobody quite knows where the money went. It certainly didn't go into development. In fact, last year, Nigeria was passing the hat around in the international community trying to get debt relief. A country that has exported hundreds of billions of dollars of oil should not be in a position to ask its creditors for debt relief, and yet it did so, and it got it, which is the amazing thing. And then you have Chile, which, again, had a per capita income well below that of Brazil. It caught up with Brazil sometime in the early 1990s, and then it has taken off, and it is, you know, much, much higher today than it was then. Korea and Chile are perhaps, you know, two of the really successful cases in what we call the emerging market world. I won't talk about Sweden. Sweden was already at a different stage of development in the mid-1970s, and it has continued on a path of prosperity and stability. Now, a number of things can be said in this regard. Number one, you could immediately say, well, but you're using an indicator, GDP per capita, which everybody knows is not a very accurate representation of human welfare. And I would readily agree with you. I would say yes. GDP per capita is a faulty measure. It is a flawed measure. But it's what we've got. It is an indicator that we have put together in the post-war period. It is compiled every year using the UN system of national accounts. We have data that we can compare across countries. It delivers some insights. It doesn't necessarily say that Swedish citizens are happier than Koreans. It doesn't say that. It does say, however, that countries at a higher level of per capita income have publics or populations that probably are better educated, that have more opportunities, that have better systems of public health, that are less constrained in terms of the choices that they face. I'm not going to be discussing much about this particular indicator, although if you're interested, we can go in that direction. I can tell you a little bit about what are some of the problems that we have with this indicator and why it doesn't quite capture human welfare. Now, I'd like to spend a little bit of time basically telling you about a project that we have in the team that I direct at the forum, where essentially what we're trying to do is trying to analyze the factors that explain the differential performance in the evolution of this indicator over time. Why is it that Korea has been so fantastically successful? In fact, if I extrapolated this chart into the past, and I took it all the way down to the late 1950s, and I included here Ghana instead of, let's say, Nigeria, What you would actually see is that back in the late 50s and the early 60s, Ghana had a per capita income that was higher than Korea. And in fact, Ghana's chart would look very much like Nigeria. So over a period of 40 years, you have this divergence that at one level, it seems like a statistical phenomena, but that has, of course, a very human counterpart. As it turns out, I was in Korea 2 days ago. Arthur was actually through. I landed on Thursday. I was there for a couple of days after a short visit to China. And it is the second time that I have been to Korea in the last 12 months. And I must say, I am thoroughly impressed. Thoroughly impressed. Especially if you know a little bit about the history of the country and where it was, after the Korean War in the late 50s. There was a very interesting debate in the development literature in the late 50s about these two countries, Ghana and Korea. Ghana was just coming out of the period of had gained independence. And there was a great deal of optimism about the future of the country. This was a country that had inherited a relatively good infrastructure, had some of the best schools in the country, and it was very rich in natural resources. Korea had nothing. To this day, Korea has nothing. Nothing that it can trade internationally in terms of commodities, oil, cocoa, whatever. And yet the development path of these countries could not have been more different. Ghana is what it was in 1960. Korea has taken off in a major way. And I guess one of the reasons I'm so impressed when I go to Korea is because you realize that what has driven the country on this development path has essentially been education and training and skills development. That is what has made the difference. But there is also something else that I find impressive, which is sort of the discipline and the focus. I attended a dinner on Wednesday night, and there were a number of top Korean businessmen. And one of the persons that had been invited to the dinner was the administrator of the airport in Seoul, the international airport. Why? Don't ask me. But in the course of the discussion, it came out that apparently there is this outfit, some kind of international organization, that ranks airports using 32 indicators. You just imagine what the indicators might be, how quickly it takes, you can clear customs, how many minutes you have to wait for your luggage to appear, etc., etc. And it turns out that the Korea International Airport ranks number one in 29 of the 32 indicators. And I believe that, having been in the airport arriving and leaving, I have traveled quite a bit, and I'm impressed, really. And what was even more impressing is that the gentleman, rather than being self-satisfied about the efficiency of the airport, was asking himself what he has to do to actually be number one in all 32 indicators. Right? And that is what makes the difference, about Korea. Now, to come back to my original question, what explains this? I mean, why is it that countries have this very divergent performance in terms of the evolution of this indicator? And of course, the answer to this question is that there are a multiplicity of factors which, in fact, explain the evolution of this indicator. You can't just pinpoint and say, it is because the Koreans long time ago learned that it is very important to manage the public finances effectively, and therefore on the basis of that they took off. It's not that. It's not as simple as that. It turns out to be a very complicated story. And in fact, because we don't have the time to develop the story fully, let me just give you the gist of it before I continue on. The gist of the story is as follows, that the number of factors which you need to explain the differences in the performance of this indicator over time across a large number of countries is huge. It's very large. The macro environment matters for sure. It matters a great deal whether you have a government like Argentina, who is totally unable, until very recently, let us hope, to manage the public finances in an effective way. Argentinians have always been living beyond their means. They have a long history of fiscal indiscipline, which then has had a huge counterpart on very, very, very high rates of inflation. So the macro environment is tremendously important, but in fact many other things matter as well. Education, the extent to which the government invests in the development of skills in the population, the quality of the country's infrastructure. Lately, the extent to which countries are utilizing the latest technologies. It turns out that whether the country is able to, you know, have access to the internet, use mobile telephones and personal computers, makes a difference in terms of improvements in efficiency and productivity and how quickly this indicator can rise. In fact, we have come up with a list of something like 90 indicators that we use to actually track and explain the evolution of this indicator. Now, furthermore, it turns out that these indicators, although they matter for all the countries, they matter differently depending on the stage of development of the country. In other words, what is tremendously important for Sweden today is not quite the same as what is important for Nigeria. What drives the development process in these two countries at two very different stages of development actually is quite different. They matter differently, these factors. Furthermore, the factors themselves change over time. What was important at a particular moment in time, let's say in the late 70s, is perhaps no longer important. Let me give you an example. Inflation was a problem everywhere in the late 70s. Even the United States have double-digit inflation. Even the UK had an IMF program. You probably don't know this, but in the mid-70s, I think it was under Jim Callaghan, the UK actually had to come to the IMF, something that normally developing countries do, but not a member of the G7 club. So there was a time not so long ago when policymakers and the development community was very much focused on, you know, how to defeat this monster called inflation. Today, that's no longer the case. Inflation has, by and large, been defeated. Central bankers have been tremendously effective in basically bringing inflation down across the world in a major way. You have to go to places like Zimbabwe, which is the pits of the world, you know, to actually get inflation rates of, let's say, a couple of 100%, which is what is happening there. All right. Now, I will come to this in a little while. Let me show you a couple of graphs very quickly. This is the average increase in per capita income during the post-war period, during a period of about 50 years. And this is a kind of a way of aggregating, the many charts which I could have shown you as the previous one. And what you can basically see is two things. I just want to focus your attention on two things. First of all, is that the global economy has grown at a rate of 2.1% per year on average during the 50-year period from 1950 to 2001. And furthermore, that when you disaggregate this, you see a very sharp differences in performance. You see, for instance, Asia, that has had the highest growth rate, 3.4, and then you see Africa at 1%. And since Argentina is a country that is very close to my heart, if I put a little indent here and I said I wrote Argentina, you would see also Argentina 1%. And so, again, you might say, well, but what's the difference between 1%, 2%? They all seem broadly relatively small numbers. Well, actually, no. If I ask you, I give you £100, Wendy, over a period of 50 years, and I ask you to deposit in a bank. In one bank, you get 1% per year, and another bank, you get 3.5% per year over a period of 50 years. The magic of compound interest basically means that you're going to have two vastly different sums of money. In fact, let's speak more specifically. Argentina, in the period between 1960, so a little bit shorter, not quite 50 years, but say between 1960 and 2000, Argentina grew on average, this indicator, GDP per capita, 1% per year. That basically means that over a period of 40 years, cumulatively, income, GDP per capita, rose by 48%. A country that during that period grew by 3%, a bit higher, GDP per capita would have grown by 200%. And there are countries that have grown much faster than that, 5%, 6%. So that's why the lines over a period of time converge to such extent. Okay, now, just a couple more. One question, of course, which you can ask yourself is what does this growth of 2% per year actually imply over a prolonged period of time in terms of the evolution of certain kinds of indicators which we think as being highly correlated with human welfare? I'm not saying anything about the environment yet. I will come to that in a little while. Just bear with me. Well, here you have three indicators that the developing community focuses on. In fact, two of these, infant mortality and life expectancy, I'm sorry, infant mortality and literacy are part of the Human Development Index put out by the UNDP. But again, notice a huge improvement over a period of four decades. Infant mortality has come down quite dramatically. Life expectancy has increased, although it has increased at a decreasing rate. There was a huge increase from 1960 to 1980, and then a somewhat smaller but still tangible increase from 1980 to 2000. There is a logic for that. I won't go into it, but you know, just think a little bit about why it might be, why it might have this sort of decelerating shape. And then illiteracy, you have 53% were illiterate in 1960, that's down to 28%. So remarkable progress, and this is very much correlated to the kind of growth performance that you see over that same period. And then very quickly here, these are indicators of poverty. Perhaps too many numbers here, but let me just focus your attention on a couple. If you use a poverty line of, let's say, $1.50 per day, what you basically see is that there has been a huge reduction in poverty levels from 1980 to 2000. This is the period of most pronounced decline in poverty. At a global level, it is a reduction of about 832 million people that have been, you know, taken out of this poverty line. But what is most interesting about this particular table is that all of the decline in poverty is actually explained by two countries. One of them is China, which is here in East Asia, and the other one is India, which is here in South Asia. These two countries actually explain more than 100% of the reduction in poverty because, in fact, poverty in Africa has increased over the same period. You can see from 188 million to 362. And, of course, as you well know, China and India have been growing very quickly. So, now, let me pause here and let me go back a little bit to what I was saying earlier on about attempts to try to come up with some kind of quantified framework that tells us something about the kinds of policies that are conducive to development. What we have done over the last couple of years at the forum is working with some leading academics, is we have come up with kind of a structure where we bring in these 90, in the end there are 90 factors, right? And we sort of classify them in sort of groups that are broadly similar in nature. Let me give you an example. For instance, there is a sense that governance and the quality of the institutional environment must be tremendously important for development. You know, property rights. Do you live in a country in which there is respect, there is a good environment for property rights, or not? Do you live in a country in which public funds are diverted for private uses? Or do you live in a country like Finland or Sweden, where the government is extremely transparent in terms of the use that it makes of tax revenue, and where levels of corruption are extremely low? How effectively does the judicial system work? Does it work like in Germany? If two companies in Germany have a problem which requires access to the judicial system, they can get justice done very quickly. It is not very expensive, and ultimately the ruling of the court or the judge will be in accordance with the law. Or is justice for sale like it is in Russia? In Russia, there is a bidding process. Whoever pays the judge more wins the case. It's as easy as that. What about the government officials? Are they sort of even-handed in the way that they behave vis-a-vis the private sector, or do they play favorites? Are they actively giving exemptions and favors to particular sectors well connected to those in power, and so on? I think you begin to get the picture. How efficiently are government resources used? I mean, do you live in a country in which tax rates are high and in which the money gets lost, gets stolen, gets spent on arms, weapons, adventures, and so on? Or does it get channeled back into the economy like it does in the Nordic countries? The Nordic countries have very high tax rates, but nobody complains very much. Why? Because the money gets invested back into excellent infrastructure, some of the best training and facilities, some of the best schools. You know that the OECD every year does a test of the abilities of the labor force in all its member countries, more 30 member countries. Reading comprehension, they have five different levels of reading comprehension for the labor force, mathematical abilities and understanding. And the Finns come number one year after year. Why? Is it that the Finns are more intelligent? Do they have better genes? No, absolutely not. It's just that the government... Well, you know, I don't know this for a fact. I simply presume. I simply presume. But I think it is a safe presumption to make, right? So, it's just that they basically have extremely good training. They invest in education. The Finnish government collects a lot of taxes, but does it return it back to the public? Of course it does. And so on. So we have grouped a large number of these factors in something called institutions. Health and education, again, you know, the literature basically has shown that investment in education is tremendous, a very, very important driver of productivity and hence economic growth. Why is it that Korea has done what it has done? It's because they have invested in education heavily. The Koreans are obsessive about education. I had asked about the role of education in the development process a few nights ago at this dinner in Korea, and some of my Korean colleagues, were telling me some anecdotes about basically how Korean families will go out of their way and will spend a huge part of their disposable income, essentially on private tutoring for their children, on getting helping them to get ahead, a little bit obsessive in fact, but the results are there. The results are there. Korea has turned itself from an agricultural society with no future in the 1960s into a global industrial power that is basically doing technological innovation and that is giving the Finns a run for their money in the area of mobile telephony through technological innovation. If the Finns don't watch out, the Korea is going to corner the market for mobile telephones. And then I think you begin to get the flavor. Obviously, I won't do everything. Here we have a number of indicators of what I call market efficiency. The World Bank has done a very interesting report. It does an annual report called Doing Business. It's a very, very interesting little project that they do once a year, where they go to countries and they look at the obstacles to the creation of new businesses. How many pieces of papers do you have to fill? How many stamps do you need? How many days does it take? How much does it cost? In other words, does the government, through its regulatory framework, introduce obstacles to the creation of new businesses and hence to the development of entrepreneurial spirit? Or is the government, in fact, playing a supportive role and making it easy? And it's interesting, but the results that come out of this study, which is done for 180 countries, are paradoxical. The countries that most need the development of the private sector, say poor African countries, are the countries where the government puts the greatest obstacles to the creation of new businesses. It is the Finlands and the New Zealands and the Australias and the Swedens of this world, which already have an extremely rich, very well-developed private sector, where the government goes out of its way to make it even easier for people who want to create new businesses. One piece of paper, 24 hours, costs nothing, more or less. So... to summarize, what we eventually did is we came up with, we sort of put these 90 factors, we eventually grouped in 9 pillars. Don't ask me why 9. I just happen to like the number 9. I don't know why. But, obviously I had some latitude in deciding the number of pillars, and it just 9 seemed like such an appealing number. So here you go. Institutions, infrastructure, macroeconomy, health and primary education, higher education and training, market efficiency, where market efficiency, I gave you a few examples of goods markets, what we call economists call goods markets, but we also have labor markets and financial markets. and then technological readiness, business sophistication, and innovation. I won't go into a more detailed discussion of, you know, how we weigh these factors differently and so on and so forth, because it would take too long. We basically split countries into what we call stages of development. And so the Chinas and the Indias, for instance, are on stage one. And so the fact, some of those factors, some of those 90 factors get weighed more heavily here. The Finlands and the USs and the Japans and the Swedens are on stage three. And so other factors get weighed more heavily there because they're more important for countries at that level of income. You know, I won't go into that in greater detail unless you're interested. Now, I just wanted to show you quickly some of the results. For instance, looking at public institutions, you know, which countries have the best property rights environment in the world? I'm looking at a group of 117 countries, by the way. And here you go, Germany, United States, Iceland, Switzerland, Denmark. These are the countries that have, you know, the best property rights environment. I've also asked my research assistant to put a few other countries which might be of interest, you know, some big ones like China and India. And as you can see, countries like China, Russia, Argentina, Venezuela have an extremely poor property rights environment. You know, I was in China a couple of days ago, four or five days ago, my organization had a business summit there. And I was moderating one of the panels. And what comes out of the discussion is this kind of paradoxical situation. On the one hand, you have China growing very quickly, but on the other hand, you talk to the business community, and they have serious concerns about precisely the institutional environment, protection of property rights, intellectual property in particular, the way that the judicial system works, issues of transparency and corruption. It is not a pretty business environment, I assure you. And the reason why China is getting huge amounts of foreign investment is because the companies, the transnationals, are essentially taking a bet for the future. But at some point, they will make money. At some point, this country, which is growing quickly, is going to have a large middle class which with large purchasing power, and they're going to be able to, you know, basically make money on the strength of that. But for the time being, not a lot of companies are making a lot of money in China. I put in Venezuela here, because it turns out that since I'm ranking 117 countries, Venezuela happens to have the worst ranking of all. And it's an interesting... I had an interesting exchange with the Venezuelan ambassador in Washington in the last few months. He had written a little article in Foreign Affairs, which is one of the leading foreign policy journals, in which he was essentially defending the Bolivarian Revolution, as it is called, of Mr. Chavez, you know, the president of Venezuela. And one of the observations that he made in his article was that the Human Development Index, which is an indicator put together by the UNDP, he said, shows that Venezuela has actually improved its position in the last few years. It turned out that he read the table completely wrong. And I just found it shocking. I mean, number one, he's the ambassador, but number two, it's Foreign Affairs, right? You know, and he read the table completely wrong. You know, what's up is down, what's down is up, you know? So even the editor of Foreign Affairs missed it. So I'm pretty sure that there will be a letter of mine, actually, to the editor in the next issue of Foreign Affairs. But in any case, you know, I won't focus on all of them, but, you know, here, public trust of politicians, I mean, it's very important, you know, do people feel that they can trust the people who are leading them? Or do they think that the country is run by crooks, which is very often the case in many parts of the world? Well, here you go. Singapore, Denmark, Finland, you know, Norway, etc., etc. At the bottom end, again, you have Russia, Brazil, India, not doing so well. I will quickly go over some of these other ones. The judicial system, again, you know, Germany, Denmark, Switzerland, Australia, these are the countries where you're going to have a legal problem. You better have them there if you have the option. You don't want to have to deal with the courts in Russia, in Argentina, in Brazil, in China, right? Interesting one. Where are government officials most impartial? You know, where do they keep an arm's length relationship with the rest of the private sector? Well, in Denmark, New Zealand, Singapore, Finland, etc. Interestingly, look at Italy, 72. Actually, every year when we come out with the results of our latest report, and we are coming out at the end of September with the new ones, the Italians always object. They're always unhappy because it always makes it to the front pages of all the Italian papers. You know, and so I get telephone calls and I get protestations. In fact, I had a kind of a very interesting exchange in January. I'll just tell you by way of anecdote. I was invited to Rome by the Minister of Information and Communications Technology to give a seminar in the ministry. He was going to invite the press, the business community, you know, many of the high-tech entrepreneurs and so on, and he wanted me to tell or explain to them, you know, sort of Italy's ranking. And I'm not surprised when I get invitations from, let's say, you know, the Finns or the Koreans or the Chileans, because they do extremely well in these indicators. But from the Italians, I was puzzled. Why not? You know, I'm always happy to spend a couple of days in Rome at somebody else's expense. So I went. And so the minister, in introducing me, very, very, very shrewd guy, by the way. Obviously, he's been around for a long time, and he thought he was going to really pull a fast one on me. So he begins the seminar by saying, well, of course, we know that many of the indicators put together by the World Economic Forum are based on a survey of the opinion of the business community. And this, of course, ultimately means that it is the subjective opinion of the Italian businessman who are basically saying that the judicial system doesn't work very well in Italy. But, you know, his implication was, who knows if this is true? You know, I mean, maybe the Italian business community is passing through a period of collective depression, and therefore one should simply discount their opinions, all right? And so, but I was prepared. And so I told him, Mr. Minister, in Italy, you know, our survey is actually conducted by the top business school in the country. We have a sample of 160 companies from all over the country, so there is not even an issue of possible regional bias. Maybe we've gone to Sicily and we're asking only Sicilians what they think about Italy. And so, you know, they're... So, and if you actually look at their responses on this issue of judicial independence, it turns out that the consensus across the business community is huge. The variance, in other words, with respect to the responses, is very, very narrow. They all feel that the system is not working very well. And so as a government minister, you can say two things. You can say, well, it's just a subjective opinion, and dismiss it, and then walk away from it, and say, well, it's the World Economic Forum who doesn't like us and is giving us this awful ranking, right? The alternative is to say, look, this is a serious problem. It may be the subjective opinion, but this is what they think. This is what they think, and they think this on the basis of their day-to-day experience with the system. Let me see. Health and primary education. Again, some of these things are not very surprising. Life expectancy at birth. The Japanese, the Australians, the Italians, the Swedes, they live the longest. Again, you know, Brazil, Russia, India don't do so well. Primary education. This is the net primary school enrollment rate. Again, you know, Japan, Denmark, Canada, Korea. Korea has come up in a huge way. Korea is impressive. You know, Korea has got the highest rates of penetration for broadband use and internet in the world. They've already exceeded industrial country levels. They're far ahead of the UK, even Finland and Sweden. There's kind of an interesting phenomena in India and China. You know, you pick up your typical issue of Business Week, and you know what you hear is about how India is becoming a technology power, how it's graduating so many hundreds of thousands of engineers every year, and you know there is this sense that this country is operating already on what we economists call the technology frontier. And then you actually look at the school enrollment rates. That's primary school, which is not so good. Right? It is 76 in the world among 117 countries. You look at actually university enrollment rate in India, it's 90. It's really, really at the bottom. And basically what you have is the situation of a country where, because it has 1.1 billion people, it can actually graduate a large number of engineers every year. But it also happens to have, at the same time, hundreds of millions of people who don't have access to the most elementary education, who are illiterate. Right? In other words, the denominator is very large because it is per capita, and when the denominator is very large, it brings down the rates in a major way. Likewise with China, actually. You know, these two countries, India and China, but despite all the hype about growth and how this is going to be the Asian century and so on and so forth, they're really technologically backward societies which have a lot of very important structural problems. A month ago, I was invited to Malaysia to give a talk with a very provocative title. I did not choose the title. It was chosen by the hosts. And the title of the talk was, "Is This the Asian Century?" And the hint at the invitation was that I was more or less supposed to explain why this was the Asian century. I disappointed them. I told them, well, no, this is not going to be the Asian century. That is not the right question. It is not a particularly interesting question either. But that's another subject, okay? But in the end, I made a case as to why this was not going to be the Asian century. And I think, I don't know whether I persuaded the whole audience, but at least... All right, so here is just some health. Health and primary education. Well, there you go. HIV, Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa, these are the worst performers. This is important. Look, in Africa, you want to talk about productivity and economic growth, you know, you don't talk about inflation and the budget. You talk about health, you talk about AIDS, and you talk about the spread of the infectious diseases. Now, those are the problems. You talk to business people in South Africa, and what is their primary worry? Their primary worry is they invest a lot of money training managers, and then the following day they don't report to work because they're checking in a hospital because they have AIDS or they have died. Those are the problems, and you know, all of these are African countries. The case of South Africa is particularly sad because you know there was a recent conference. I think it was in Switzerland, a WHO event, at which they had booths, and in the booths they had for a number of countries, and in each booth they had the Minister of Health of the particular country basically saying what they were doing about HIV/AIDS in their respective countries. And the Minister of Health of South Africa was basically giving kind of homemade recipes for HIV, including lemonade and garlic and a few other things, right? Which then led one of the top officials of the WHO, in extremely undiplomatic language, to say that the South Africa officials, when it comes to discussion of AIDS, are basically on the lunatic fringe, which is, you know, very, very strong words if you think about it. And of course, President Mbeki has actually gone on record as saying that he has actually never met somebody with AIDS. This is the indicator of number of procedures to start a new business, where the leading countries in the world again are already rich countries. You want to start a business in Brazil or in Argentina, and I don't remember exactly the data, but it may take 6 months. You may have to bribe 10 officials, and you may need 17 forms or 50 forms to fill out. I'm going to show you. Let's skip some of these. There's too much. Okay, let me show you sort of three or four charts which I think are quite revealing. On the horizontal axis, I have here the ranking of the countries, sort of using these 90 indicators. In other words, the top country, the number one, which happens to be Finland, and so on. So this is called the Global Competitiveness Index, this aggregate measure that we have developed. And here on the horizontal axis, what I've done is I've taken a handful of the indicators, and in this particular case, those that capture the macro environment. And I basically just wanted to see, you know, to what extent, what is the degree of correlation, if you wish, between how competitive a country is, which tells me something about its ability to grow, you know, like Sweden, like Korea, and the quality of the macro environment. And what you discover is that, yeah, there is a correlation, but actually it's, you know, the numbers are all over the place, more or less. Right? You can have situations like, for instance, Japan and India, you know, here India and here Japan, which have a macro environment that is broadly similar, in other words, they're on the same vertical line, and yet there is no question that Japan, you know, has a far more competitive economy than India, you know, has a much higher ranking. Think of it as there's a huge gap. Which basically tells you what? It tells you that there are many other things in Japan that are working so much better than they are in India. Education, public health, infrastructure, you know, the levels of efficiency of the government and the business community and so on. Now, so that's not particularly interesting. However, let me show you a couple of far more interesting charts. This one, again, the same measure on the vertical axis, but here on the horizontal axis, I have investment in higher education and training. And look, here the relationship is not only a much tighter fit. You know, the countries are basically, you know, strung out in a very nice, very elegant way along this line, but this line happens to be non-linear. In other words, what does it mean? It means that a 1% increase in education and training leads to a more than 1% increase in your level of competitiveness, or say improvement in productivity. And this is actually one of the more interesting lessons of development of the last 50 years, right? That increasingly education and training, human capital development of your capacities and your talents, those of the population, are, you know, the most important investment that a country can make in its future. And another one that is really quite interesting is this one, where, again, same vertical axis, but on the horizontal axis, what I've done is we've taken a handful of measures of use of high technologies. Internet, mobile telephones, personal computers, broadband, you know, a few others. Fixed telephones and so on. And again, look, you know, the returns to investing in high tech are huge. The relationship is very, very, you know, very, very well established. Okay, now, what about the environment? Well, look, I guess what I'm trying to say in my remarks is that the policy framework, the policy environment, is tremendously important. In other words, it matters a great deal for development, for the evolution of human welfare across this large number of countries, the kinds of institutions that you develop, the sort of policies that governments implement, the framework that is established in the country. Now, Arthur Dahl, a couple of years ago, did a very interesting piece of work for us at the forum. And I wanted to, obviously, it's slightly awkward for me to do it since he's sitting here in front and he would be able to do it much better. So I will ask him to interrupt me if I am misrepresenting the kind of work that he did. But maybe not too much because I read his work very carefully. I was actually the editor of the report which included his piece. But one of the things we wanted to sort of look at a little bit is there a kind of a correlation of sorts between what I would broadly characterize as commitment to environmental protection in these countries on the one hand, and competitiveness and productivity on the other? In other words, are countries that pay more attention to environmental concerns, to efficiency and the use of resources and a number of other factors, are these countries more competitive? And therefore, are they the Swedens and the Koreas of this world, or are they the Nigerias and the Argentinas of this world? And so we asked Arthur to look into this issue, and we gave him the opportunity to use our survey. We do this survey in 100+ countries. And he actually designed a set of questions which were included in the survey, in the general survey, which then we went ahead and did in all over the world, basically getting the opinions of business leaders, thousands and thousands of them. And essentially what Arthur did is he included 20 questions in the survey, right? And he split them into three broad groups. One set of questions had to do with government action, things like environmental regulations and enforcement, standards and reporting requirements, compliance with respect to international environmental agreements and so on. In other words, you know, how well are governments doing in this area? A second set of questions had to do with basically business attitudes, you know, towards environmental issues. You know, things like environmental managed systems and reporting, are they being put in place? Environmental marketing and labeling, cleaner production and waste reduction, energy efficiency and long-term planning and so on. And then finally, a third set of questions tackled issues of what we would call broadly corporate social responsibility. You know, codes of conduct, socially and environmentally responsible investment, encouragement of voluntary social activities by employees, and so on. And so, eventually what he did is he ranked countries according to how they were doing in these indicators. And what he didn't do then, because we hadn't yet developed this index, but what I have asked my research assistants this week to do is basically to show me exactly the kind of chart that I was showing you before. How does this chart look like using Arthur's indicators? In other words, is there a very tight, very, very, very direct correlation that basically shows that the more environmentally conscious and responsible a country is, you know, it will have higher levels of competitiveness and productivity and therefore a better growth performance over time or not, or to what extent? And this is what it looks like. Right? I haven't put the country names. We didn't have the time to do that. It's a fairly tedious thing to do. But what can I say? How would you characterize this Arthur when you look at the numbers? Again, here is the Global Competitiveness Index on the one hand. Here are the Arthur's environmental and social responsibility rankings. Right. Certainly, there is a high correlation. It seems to show that there is a positive correlation between the extent to which countries do well in the indicators that Arthur developed on the one hand, and the extent to which countries are competitive according to the definition that we use of competitiveness, which is very broad and includes 90 factors. And so here you will have, you know, the Swedens and the Finlands, and of course you will have the Nigerias and so on. In fact, to show you what was Arthur's original ranking, you know, when he did the study a couple of years ago, these are the countries that were the best. Sweden, Japan, Denmark, Finland, Netherlands, Switzerland. These are the countries where management of the environment is the most developed, where the business community and the government are working most effectively to use resources efficiently, to protect the environment, to introduce systems of reporting and accounting, and so on and so forth. It's an interesting list, but it has, you know, it has countries that, you know, you're not surprised to see there. Although actually in the top 20 you have countries that are not there that you're a little surprised not to see there, like the United States, for instance, is not here. And then here you have the worst 20. I don't have anything against Venezuela in particular, but Venezuela seems to have been a part of all my worst indicators. It is a bit of a nightmarish country actually, but I think Bolivia is there too. Yeah. So there you go. That's. I think it is an interesting result. Yes. No, we haven't done that. Actually, as I was coming in the bus from the airport this morning, one of the things that I thought that would be interesting to do would be to differentiate here Arthur's indicators, because he's got three groups. You know, he's got the government, he's got the business community, and then he has these other issues that capture corporate social responsibility. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have sort of the three sub elements and see how they plot. But we'll do that next this week. Michael.
Such a classic case of exporting these people.
Yes, please. No, you're absolutely right. We do plan to do that. I'm hampered a little bit by the fact that I having just developed this new instrument, this index, I don't have a time series to work on, that would allow me to say something about the evolution of these relationships over time. However, on the positive side, I have, obviously this is not a presentation about this new methodology that we have developed. But I have done that actually recently, two times in the World Bank, to the senior staff of the Africa region and Latin America region, to the Millennium Challenge Corporation and a few other places. And people actually like this very much. Among other things, why? Because it provides an opportunity for a very important broadening of the debate about what matters for development. I used to be an economist at the IMF for many years. Arthur knows that because his brother was an economist at the IMF, a good friend of mine. And in the IMF, you're very focused on the macro picture, essentially, which is important, but it doesn't begin to tell even half of the story. To really tell the story, you have to go into education, you have to go into human capital, you have to go into corruption and governance and so on. You read the papers in the last couple of days, there is a huge debate at the World Bank at the moment and at the annual meetings of the IMF and the World Bank in Singapore, because the president of the World Bank, Mr. Wolfowitz, is being attacked because he has brought corruption issues very much into the forefront. I applaud that, by the way, simply because of my own development experience. I think that the World Bank and the IMF and other development organizations should be very careful that the resources are not misused, they go to finance development, not to finance private bank accounts in unnamed countries. But he's being attacked from inside the organization as well as some of the members because, well, they don't like it. I mean, the argument which they're making is that if you are too strict, then you're going to end up hurting the people, right? And obviously you have a country whose leaders perhaps are corrupt, but if you withhold lending from the country because the leaders are corrupt, ultimately you end up hurting the poor. I'm not persuaded by that argument, by the way, but that's the argument that is being made. Yes? Please. One among 90.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Oh, we do. Absolutely. The problem is that I have only shown you a handful of the factors, but strength auditing and accounting standards is there. I assure you. We under the institutions pillar, we break it into two. We have public institutions, which is what I showed you, and then we have something called private institutions, where we have accounting standards, we have work ethics, and we have nepotism and things like that, which are actually we included partly as a result of our examination of the experience of the Enrons of this world and so on. Yeah, so we have it. Yes. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It may have been a factor in the early stages when you're right, you know, there was foreign aid and so on. But I don't think that it would explain, you know, the whole story. Really, really, I don't think it would. I think the story is far too complex to simply be attributed, you know, to the fact that the Americans were present, you know, perhaps generously in the early part of that period, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. I think it has more to do with domestic policy. It has more to do with leadership. It has more to do with, you know, culture and the character of the people, their value system. Again, when I go there and I meet and talk to them and I see their focus and their ambition and so on, it really stands in such sharp contrast, you know, with, say, for instance, Latin America, with the exception of Chile. I mean, I don't mean to make sort of easy characterizations, right? But just give you an anecdote. A year ago, I was invited by the government in Korea, and to give a presentation. And basically, the title of the presentation, which they put for me, was "What do we need to do to be top 10 in your indicators?" Right? And when I went there, you know, the meeting was, the prime minister was this, the finance minister was this, I mean, the highest level of the government. And it was interesting because if you really want to tell them what they need to do, you have to tell them some very painful things. And what I was very impressed is that they were actually quite ready to hear those painful things. It turns out that in Korea, the reason they're not top 10 in these indicators is not because they haven't done enough on education and innovation and technology. They've done enough, actually. They're already, you know, ahead of many of the industrial countries, including several G7 countries. It's not because they're not managing their macro economy well. They're actually, after the crisis of 97, they've learned a few bitter lessons, and now they're doing things excellently. The reason why Korea is not top 10 is because, unlike Finland and Sweden, they don't have the degree of transparency and honesty and cleanliness in government that the Nordic countries have. There are these sort of dark, opaque relationships between the government and some of the large industrial groups. There's favoritism, there's sweet deals, there's a kind of a symbiotic relationship between the top business community in Korea and the government. And they are aware of it, and our indicators show this very clearly. So I had to tell them, you know. I didn't worry particularly about offending them. I just had to tell them. You ask me the question, I have to tell you what the answer is. I didn't quite say you guys are corrupt, but, you know, but it was subtext to the discussion. Yes. Right. I have great sympathy for your observations. The only thing I would say is that not everywhere, but certainly in some of the more successful countries, the government and the authorities and the policymakers are, of course, deeply aware of the limitations of GDP per capita, or GDP as an indicator of human welfare. And for that very reason, they go beyond and they do more in terms of the environment, in terms of public health, in terms of providing a safety net for children and single mothers and old people and so on and so forth. Right? It's precisely because they understand that you cannot guide your policy by an indicator which has, you know, very great limitations. I think it's important, you know, in other words, this is an indicator that suggests something about human welfare. Right? It doesn't capture all the aspects of human welfare. As long as we are conscious of its limitations, and as long as we supplement public policy with a number of other elements which are not captured by the indicator, which are nevertheless important for human welfare, then we should be okay. But I agree with you in the sense that this indicator, is very much at the center of policymaking. It is the indicator that gets reported in the press, and in some way it has tended to dominate the debate about development. But we have to be aware of its limitations, and we have to go beyond. Yes. Okay. No, it doesn't. We use indicators that basically are aggregate for the whole population. We have done another study last year looking at the issue of gender, and I don't have enough time to go into this, but we have a little research agenda looking at gender issues as well, and we have one of the results that we have is that again. Those countries that have been the most successful in narrowing inequality between men and women also happen to be the most competitive economies in the world. Sweden, Finland, all these countries are actually the ones that have been most successful in narrowing that gap between however measured, education, opportunity, health, etc. Yes, they do. They do. But essentially. No, what they do, which I think is the appropriate way to go about it at this particular stage, is that once a year, we publish the 600-page report, and for each country, we have a kind of a profile. Of all these indicators, which essentially shows, their strengths and their weaknesses, where they're doing well and where they could do better. And then that becomes the platform for debate. So to go to the example of Korea, not to repeat myself, let me give you an example from Chile. This is a real-world example a couple of years ago. In the report, we did a case study on Chile, because Chile is one of the most successful development stories of the last 15 years. Chile went back to democracy in 1990, and from that period on, in the last 16 years, has been one of the countries that has had the greatest, not only one of the highest rates of growth in the world, but has had the greatest success in reducing poverty and addressing income distribution problems, which is, one of the challenges that we face in the world today. Even in countries like China and India, which are growing very quickly, income disparities are widening. And so we wanted to understand better, why has Chile done so well? What are the factors that explain? And furthermore, what are the challenges? What do they need to do better in the future? And what was really interesting about that particular case study is the debate that it generated domestically in the country. At the highest levels, op-eds in the paper, a debate, etc., etc. And it was such a high-minded debate, number one. And number two, the conclusion that they came to is that their greatest weakness is education. That is where they are really falling behind. They already have institutions which are operating at the level of the average of the European Union. In fact, if I took a look at the indicators looking at public institutions and I rank Chile against the 25 members of the European Union, Chile comes number 8. In other words, it's already above the median. It is certainly much better than Italy and Greece and many of the East, Central, and Eastern European countries. And yet, when you actually look at education, they're way, way behind Finland and Ireland and New Zealand and these top performers. And so that is where they're lagging behind. Now, interestingly, in looking at the reasons why they're doing so poorly, they themselves came up with some very interesting observations about the Chilean educational system. One of the things that they discover is that, actually, we have no way of assessing the quality of our teachers. They get lifetime employment. There's a very powerful teachers trade union, and basically they're untouchable. You want to fire a bad teacher? it's easier to depose a general from the Chilean army than it is to fire a teacher. Well, lo and behold, through a great deal of sort of consensus building and tension and you know, stress, the Chileans finally this year introduced a system of basically assessing teachers. Assessing teachers and training them and firing them, the really bad ones. You know, the labor unions eventually accepted this. And so this is part of a step in which, you know, they decided to improve the education. And the other thing they decided, which I thought was admirable, at a time when many, a great part of the continent is, you know, is passing through a stage of anti-Americanism, the Chileans decided, as a policy goal of the government, that by 2020, they want the Chilean labor force to have the same degree of English comprehension and understanding of the Finnish labor force. Now, I think they will fail, because in Finland, as far as I know, everybody already speaks English. But it's a very high standard, and I think it's the kind of spirit that you know, governments should be focused on. And so what they will do, they will spend heavily in education in English, because they have come to the conclusion that if you don't speak English in this day and age, you're out of it. A sad fact, but a true fact. That's a tough question.
Yeah.
Right. The issue of aid effectiveness, the issue of, you know, William Isbury, a very, very noted American economist, has written a couple of books, actually, in the last few years, but one of them, the most recent one, which I haven't yet read, but which is in my to-do list, it's called The White Man's Burden. And it basically talks about how the development community has sunk in about, I think, $580 billion in Africa in the last 40 years, right? To have the results of Nigeria, right? And Ghana and so on. In other words, there's not much to show for it. And so he's really raising very fundamental questions about why aid has not in fact worked, right? And now, it turns out that the answer to that question is a very complex one. It's a very, very complex one. There are people in the World Bank, like the chief economist, who will argue that, yes, it hasn't worked through the end of the Cold War, right? Because the aid essentially was a substitute for the Cold War. You know, the French would support their colonies, the Americans would support the Mobutus and the Marcos of this world, and so on and so forth. And therefore, a lot of it was wasted. But they argued that after the end of the Cold War, the focus of aid has shifted, the efficiency of it has increased, and therefore, if you look at the latest data, in fact, the story that comes out of it is not so bad. Having said that, it seems to me that if we really want to help Africa, then what we ought to do is we ought to open up our markets for their products. That we don't do. You know, the costs associated with trade restrictions on agricultural exports from Africa are far, far larger for the African continent than whatever aid we give them. The best aid that we can give them is just open up our markets, but we don't do that. We don't do that, unfortunately, which is one of the saddest stories of the last 50 years.